Today's edition of the Derek Hunter Podcast is brought to you by Life Change Tea.
Why go to getthetea.com? Because this important news could change your life. Socrates made a statement saying that all disease starts in the gut. Take care of your gut, and well, the rest speaks for itself. Life Change Tea is a wonderful way to aid in your digestion. Brew it, steep it, drink it, and feel it go to work. We at Life Change Tea have been around for years helping people just like you feel better. Lots of testimonials and lots of happy people. Log on to getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. Getthetea.com.
Alrighty, hello again everyone and welcome to it. It's Friday, the 23rd of October, 2020. It's the Derek Hunter Podcast. I am the Derek Hunter. Thank you so much for listening, downloading, and telling a friend, spreading the word, sharing on social media, and all that good stuff. It's the debate reaction show. This show, this part of the show, is being recorded before the debate so as to make the reaction show much easier to edit together rather than have to do it all at once. We're going to be joined by Brian Darling to go through the final debate on the mute button and the scandals and everything immediately in the aftermath. And if all goes right, meaning none of my computers crash, this will be posted and you won't even notice that it was recorded incredibly late and put up just in the nick of time. That's how dedicated I am to being current. Damn it. Patting myself on the back. You can email me, DerekAllenHunter@gmail.com. Don't forget, tomorrow, the real reaction to the week, and holy Frank Tanana, was this a week to react to, on the Curse Show at patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast, where we'll let loose with the language. Treat the news the way it deserves to be treated, like the dirty, dirty, dirty little man that it is. We'll treat it like Jeffrey Toobin treats himself in a Zoom call. But with the happier ending or less happy ending, I don't know. There'll be no cleanup required. That's all I know. So before we get to me and Brian Darling reacting to the debate, I just have to give a hat tip to Life Change Tea at getthetea.com. It's the tea that makes you go, keeps you regular, cleans you out, and allows you to get more energy from the food that you eat. That's right. You're stopped up. You're clogged up. You're sort of coated on the inside. Life Change Tea takes care of that. Use as directed. Don't overdo it or you'll end up on the toilet all weekend. But use as directed. It cleans you out. And you notice another pep in your step, more pep in your step. What's going on? I feel young again. That's what Life Change Tea does for you. It changes your life. And at checkout, enter promo code Derek, D-E-R-E-K. Click apply. You get free fast shipping on top of a great product and a great feeling. Thanks to them. Thanks to you guys for listening and all of that. Now we get to the point. Through the magic of editing and a couple of hours passing and watching that damn debate, we get to the debate reaction program. Okay, well, there you go. Literally 5 minutes ago, the debate ended, and Brian Darling and I are on Skype ready to talk about it. First of all, Brian, I guess an important question, perhaps the most important question. Did you watch the debate?
I did. I watched it beginning until the end.
Good, good. My initial impression is that Donald Trump did better than I thought. I thought he would come out. I thought he would be good. He's one of those guys who rises to the occasion. I thought he mopped the floor. I thought he forgive the French, but I thought he beat the shit out of Joe Biden.
I thought he did pretty good. I thought he did a lot better than the first debate. All the reports are saying he didn't do any debate prep, so he definitely exceeded expectations. And
Joe Biden did nothing but debate prep. He hasn't left his house since June in preparation for this debate. But it was a hell of a debate. It was substantive. I thought that most of the questions were fair. I was surprised and impressed with Kristen Welker. I got to give her a hat tip, my initial impression anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this was very fair. And, you know, in the end, you could see that President Trump gave her kind of a nod saying thank you. And, in the middle of the debate, he actually congratulated her on being more fair than I guess he expected. So
no, way more fair than I thought it, than I expected, too.
Yeah, and there was a lot of policy. It was good to hear discussion of energy policy and foreign policy and things that you just didn't think would be part of a deep dive. You know, we all prepared for more of a pitted battle between Hunter, you know, the fact that Hunter Biden is kind of looming over this debate, and you know, the allegations that Trump has a bank account in China and all that stuff. But they did have substantive debates and the Green New Deal and tax policy and all the things that we did really want to hear about.
I thought that Trump handled the China question great. It's like, I closed that 2015. Like, we're going to thinking about doing business back in 2012. Didn't do it. We closed the account back in 2015. It's been reported. It's out there. We haven't hit it. Joe Biden, still surprisingly to me, Brian, other than just being indignant and being loud is not a defense, but he doesn't seem to have much of a defense when it comes to the corruption allegations against him and his family. He doesn't seem to have that other than, I never did. No. That's you. You're the one who's corrupt. Like, dude, that's not really a defense. That it's not Russian propaganda that they somehow managed to put this laptop together 2 years ago. On the off chance that you run for president, it was before he even ran for president that this laptop was brought in for service because Hunter soiled it somehow. And like long before you were running for president, this laptop was turned in by Hunter because he screwed it up. You can't just say that's Russian propaganda. You can't just go, well, 50 people said this. You've got an actual human being. A guy who did business with your kid coming out yesterday, saying, hey, these emails are accurate. It's not like it's being made up. Vladimir Putin would have to be a master of the universe, and we'd all be foolish to go against him if, you know, he's this powerful to set these dominoes up like this. I thought Joe Biden didn't have an answer still to that.
That's right. He had no answer. He did not provide a defense. He didn't explain anything. He didn't even try to mount a real defense to the allegations other than just saying that they're not true over and over again. It's just not true. You know, it's Russian disinformation. It's not true. He never got into the weeds to say why it wasn't true. And whether the allegation, you know, it comes down to a lot of things. And one of the things is that there are some facts that have been thrown out there that could be proved or disproved very easily. It was a laptop dropped, or a number of laptops dropped off in Delaware by Hunter Biden at a local store to get them fixed. True or false? Well, if that's true, then was there information in them that ended up being very compromising to Hunter Biden and Joe Biden? And is that true or false? And then you have the press conference today with one of the associates of Hunter Biden basically saying, look, I've got all these text messages that further prove these allegations. Is that true or untrue? And Joe Biden never, ever addressed any of the specific issues surrounding it.
There's really only a couple of options. Hunter Biden is out there using his dad's name and introducing him to people for business purposes without telling him. And that's pretty bad, pretty sleazy. Or Joe was aware of it and cool with it and in on it on some level. There's really no third option because the laptop is real. The emails have been confirmed. The schedules jive with various meetings that Hunter had set up and so on and so forth. And he's denying something that is provably true, which if we had honest journalists in this country, of course, that's the big if, would lead to more questions, would lead to more reporting, would lead to a bigger inquisition. Not that he's faced anything so far, but it would be a big deal. It should be a big deal because he's denying things that are provably true at this point.
Absolutely right. I mean, he has to do something, say something about it. Like, maybe the media is just going to give him a pass and they'll just say, oh, look, it's Rudy Giuliani bringing this stuff up and basically push it off because of that, because they don't like the fact that Giuliani's involved in this investigation. But bottom line is, you know, these the stories are circulating that the laptops are in the possession of the FBI. There was an investigation going on at some point. I mean, these are serious allegations that need to be investigated. And, you know, if you want to get to the bottom of it, you know, if Joe Biden's correct and this is a Russian disinformation campaign, then why don't we have an investigation and find that out and get that out to the American public? Because if he wants to get to the bottom of it and clear his name, that would be the smartest move.
All right. If this is a Russian disinformation campaign, there were a lot of people in the United States involved in it. And if we have a whole bunch of Russian agents running around Delaware or having run around Delaware, now running around the country, we should find them. There should be a thorough and complete investigation into this. But there is no way on God's green earth that Joe Biden is going to open the door to that. You know it as well as I do. But I thought that, you know, you could tell I thought that the moderator, Welker, was uncomfortable with this topic coming up, but she also was resigned to this topic coming up and did give it a little bit of room to breathe, to her credit, unlike Chris Wallace, who stomped all over everything that the president tried to bring up. So it was different. There's obviously a lot more developments now that you can't ignore. But I thought that she handled that about as well as could be. What would you say was, give me a good debate moment?
I mean, what was the best debate moment? I mean, there were a couple of pretty strong moments, but I think the fact towards the end, I think that Trump was hammering Biden on fracking. He was hammering him on and got Biden to say he was going to get rid of oil and gas and getting rid of the oil and gas industry. I mean, a couple times, you know, right towards the end, some real big punches were landed by Trump. I think the fact that he had him on the defensive on those big policy issues was really damaging to Joe Biden. I think that the fact that Hunter Biden stuff wasn't rebutted, and the fact that it actually came up, I think it was important that Trump brought it up, because, you know, you saw a bunch of the squishy Republican talking head saying, oh, don't bring it up, let the moderator bring it up, or keep it on policy, whatever you do, don't get into the Hunter Biden stuff. Well, he did, and it worked, and he's pushing that out into the debate because the media won't do it themselves. I think the biggest takeaway for me is the fact that Hunter Biden again was pushed out there, and that forces the media to cover it.
But I mean, we'll know more in the morning Joe. I'm sure we'll find a way to ignore it because that's what they do. But there does come a point where they just look absurd and they can't. Joe Biden saying that he wants to, you know, basically get rid of, he said, I'm not against fracking. There's video of him all over the place saying he's against fracking. He's against fracking. I don't know how he can sit there and say that. Maybe he doesn't remember that he said it.
Yeah.
But he said it countless times. He did say that he wants to get rid of fracking on federal lands, too. Sure, yes, he did add that. But he has been against fracking and said he's against fracking countless times. His running mate said she would ban fracking on day one on federal lands and work to get rid of fracking everywhere as quickly as possible after that. So I'm not really sure that he can stand up to that one. But again, it would require an honest media, and that's the $64,000 question. Did you think anybody hurt themselves tonight?
No, I don't think so. I think when you look at this debate, everybody kind of hit what they wanted to hit, and there wasn't as many interruptions, and, you know, Trump was more well-behaved. I think when you look at the overall picture of what both walk out and say is they're both going to say they won the debate, but bottom line, they both kind of, you know, did what they needed to do to get out of the debate. But I do, stepping back again, you know, we're looking at an election right now where if you look at the polls, it's showing some danger signs for Democrats again in the Rust Belt. You have a Minnesota Senate race that all of a sudden has become tight, and that wasn't supposed to be tight at all. You've got a Michigan Senate race that is tight. That indicates that those states might be a lot closer than the polls are indicating. And all Trump, you know, as we know, Trump, his pathway to victory runs through Florida, and it runs through a Rust Belt state, and it runs through Arizona, or two Rust Belt states if you don't get Arizona. And it's looking like, you know, in those states, there are some danger signs for Democrats showing that Trump has a pretty good chance. If he can pick up, if he picks up one Rust Belt state, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, or Minnesota, he's likely to pick up two, and he's going to end up winning the presidency again. And we'll watch Democrats' heads explode.
You're a lawyer. What do you make of, you went to law school, you're not a practicing lawyer, you escaped, luckily for you. What do you make of these court decisions where, like, you can count the ballots 6 days after Election Day if they come in. Don't worry about postmarks, things like that. That just seems, I get that judges are ideological or can be ideological, but my God, that is inviting fraud. That is daring fraud to come along.
Yeah, and you do have a federal hook. I mean, you have a election for president of the United States, and if one state says, you know, what if one state says, hey, you know, we're going to allow voting right up until, I don't know, the end of November? Like, you can't. The Constitution sets a date for the presidential election, and that makes it a federal issue. So the fact that you can postmark and send in ballots, and all they have to do is be postmarked on election day, and whenever they get there, and you have to count them. You know, I understand that states do have dominion over voting, but they can't go too far. There is a federal hook. If they change the rules in a way that makes it so that their voters in their state have more of a right to vote than voters in another state, you're creating a really big conflict between the federal, you know, date of election versus the states, and the states, the way that they put together their electoral votes and send them to Washington, D.C. You might have another federal case on it. And we noticed that, you know, Pennsylvania's got a big battle going on whether it's okay to mail in your ballot on election day and it gets there 3 days later and still gets counted. Well, that's going to be litigated. And if the whole election comes down to Pennsylvania, we're going to see that all play out in the courts, not in the traditional manner of people actually voting for president. It's going to come down to, yet again, the courts winding its way all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court all over again.
My problem is that this is done by decrees by the governor. It's not being passed by state legislatures. It's not there are laws on the books, and the governor is looking at it and going, that's neat. I'm going to change it. And that's the problem. I don't understand how that stands up to scrutiny in any of these states, because I don't think that these legislatures, any of them, have empowered governors with superpowers to change election law.
Yeah, and that's you know, the way that these state judges get elected too and get appointed. I mean, you've got a issue there too, where, you know, these judges are making more political decisions than they are making decisions based on law. I mean, as you know, a law is made when a legislature passes something and a governor or president signs it, not the other way around. It doesn't come from decree from the governor. But no, I do agree. I mean, these are legitimate cases that will wind their way through the courts, and they're going to be resolved one way or the other. I mean, the whole Pennsylvania situation is bizarre, where you have double, you know, ballot inside a ballot, and it's going to be postmarked on election day, but not all ballots have postmarks on it. It's going to create a huge mess if it's a close election. If it's not, then it'll be a moot point.
Back to the debate. Was there any topic that you wanted to see come up that didn't?
I wish there was a deeper dive on the federal debt. How about a discussion of how we're going to dig ourselves out from our, what, $27 trillion in debt? I mean, we heard a lot of talk about spending and spending more money, not much discussion about how to actually protect our future generations from all the debt we're heaping on their shoulders. That was not mentioned at all. I think that, you know, some of the discussion about the domestic strife we're having, you know, the riots and continuing daily riots in Portland, and what we saw, like, how would you address that? Like, what's the federal role in going at that situation and establishing some law and order? That never came up. I mean, stuff that Americans really care about. And you know, you hear a lot of talk. There was a lot of talk about Kim Jong-un and, you know, negotiating with these different countries and the Paris Climate Accords. I don't think many people care about those issues that much. They do care about fracking if they're working in the industry, if they're live in, you know, Pennsylvania, they care about oil and gas policy. But for the most part, you didn't hear any bread and butter issues. You didn't hear very many discussions about issues that actually people actually care about on a day-to-day basis, which I think is a missed opportunity. It was all inside the Beltway talk.
Well, there was about shutdowns in the economy, and it was under the banner of coronavirus. And Joe Biden, I think, kind of screwed himself a little bit there by his, I will defer to the experts, I will do this. And Trump, I think, I don't know, because we live inside the Beltway, so it's tough to know what's going on outside in the rest of the country. But there seems to me, just from talking to people on my radio show, getting emails from listeners to this podcast and people who read my columns, that there really is lockdown fatigue. And Joe Biden seems to leave no room for addressing people's concerns. He almost, well, we'll give people money to make them okay. But where that money's coming from and how much and how you'll get anything passed, that's too complicated to ask. We'll give them money to make them okay, but we have to basically shut down bars, shut down restaurants, shut down gyms, were the things that he listed there. It didn't seem to speak, in my mind, to people who are willing to take that risk. Who are willing, look, I know the rules. I'll wash the hell out of my hands. I have 50 gallons of Purell. I have masks. I'm ready to go back to work. My business or my employer, look, we need to pay our bills. Let's get going. There's a large swath of the population out there who has that sentiment that Joe Biden fumbled on, in my opinion.
Yeah. And again, you know, that's a great issue where I think the questions could have been better. Like, I think most Americans want to know, when are we going to get better testing, more available testing, faster testing? You know, when are tests going to be in the schools so you can have instant testing and, you know, you can actually send your kids to school? When are we going to have, there was talk about the research that's being done on getting vaccinations. And, you know, I wish they would do a deeper dive on that issue. Like, how do you incentivize vaccinations to come quicker? You know, Trump kind of conclusively says, oh, it's coming in a few weeks, but I want to know more. I actually want to know, you know, what stage are they at? What are you doing to expedite it? Who are you calling, using your powers as president to call these people and say, hey, speed it up? Or are you actually giving them money or tax incentives? And same with Biden. Like, what's your plan? How are you going to speed it up? How would you get it out there quicker?
It's 11 o'clock.
That's what people care about. I think people care about that a lot more.
Joe made a lot of, on COVID, he made a lot of bold statements for which there was no backup at all. He said, we'll get this under control. We need to lock down the virus, not the economy. And like, what does that mean? That's something you pull from a fortune cookie. That's not a plan. I thought that Trump hammered him hard and well on and something he didn't really do in the first debate is, you were there. You've had 47 years in Washington. You never did this. Why the hell didn't you do it? If you have all these great plans, if you have these ideas, if you have these wonderful things you want to do, why didn't you do them when you had the chance to do them? Joe didn't really have an answer for that at all. He just kind of distracted, said things like, hey, he did kind of, I was surprised. At one point on, I think it was on immigration. I can't remember exactly what the topic was, but I think it was immigration where President Trump pointed out how you had 8 years. You didn't do anything. Now you say you've got this plan. You're going to do X, Y, and Z. You promised to do this before. Why didn't you do it? And Biden said something along the lines, I was vice president. I didn't have control. Like basically saying, that's Obama's fault that we didn't address this immigration issue. It's not my fault. It's not my problem. And I thought, a lot of Democrats will vote for Joe Biden because he was Barack Obama's vice president. Joe Biden doesn't inspire anybody, but they'll vote for him because he's Obama's guy. And all right, I'll go if Obama says it. But I thought that moment was like, I remember sitting there going, whoa, dude, you just kind of threw Obama under the bus. So you said, hey, Obama sucked on this. I didn't.
Yeah, he totally threw him under the bus. Threw him under the bus hard. And then, you know, he came up with another excuse later saying, oh, you know, Republicans were in control of Congress the last, you know, 6 years that we were there. He basically had a lot of excuses for not doing all that much. And that's his weakest point. I think that's where Trump was very strong in saying, you were vice president for 8 years. You've been in Washington for 47 years. And what are your accomplishments? Well, one of them is a crime bill that Biden runs away from every time it comes up. I mean, it's amazing how Joe Biden's been really bad at saying and explaining anything that he actually did when he was in the Obama administration. I guess he talks a little bit about Obamacare, but now he's saying, oh, I want Biden care where I'm going to add in a public option. And that's just, I think it just shows that he hasn't really done anything. It really is a good point that President Trump makes when he hammers him, saying, you've been in town for 47 years. You're a vice president for 8 years. What'd you do that you're proud of? Not that you're going to explain away and say, hey, we didn't do enough on this. We didn't get this passed. You know, I'm sorry about the crime bill. It was a mistake. What did you do? Like, what did you do that you're proud of that you can spike the football on?
Right. Well, his biggest legislative accomplishment up until running this time was the crime bill. Back in 2008, when he was running against Obama and everybody, he was touting that he was the guy who wrote the crime bill, blah, 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 blah. And it's like,
but it's also
now
weird.
He can't.
He when he was a senator, he used to always talk about, oh, Violence Against Women Act. I was the one that, you know, pushed that through. He never mentions it. It's really weird. It's almost like he forgets a lot of the things he actually worked on. And that's a dangerous sign, too.
The Democratic Party has changed so dramatically that, you know, what would be 5 years ago a strength in the Democratic Party is now a weakness. The law and order idea. They've all sort of, everybody kind of law and order, supported law and order, except for the occasional lunatic member of Congress. And now law and order is a four-letter word in Democratic circles. So they can't run on the things that they've been running on forever. That's why she was a horrible candidate, but I think that was part of the reason that sunk Kamala Harris, was that she was a prosecutor. She put a lot of people in prison. And as a nominee, Tulsi Gabbard took a sword to her and just sliced her up on that. Whereas any other cycle before that one, I think that would have been a strong. So yes, I put a lot of violent criminals away. I put a lot of drug dealers away. And now you kind of have to go, gee, I'm sorry I put violent criminals away. And shucks, I wish I hadn't put all those violent criminal drug dealers away and things like that. It's so bizarre how quickly and dramatically the Democratic Party has changed in a very short period of time to me.
One thing that I actually liked that Biden said today was he talked about getting rid of mandatory minimums. And my former boss, Senator Rand Paul, worked with Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont on a bill to get rid of, not to get rid of mandatory minimums, but to give judges the authority to sentence below mandatory minimums, because you have a lot of drug crimes that people end up getting locked up for really long periods of time for stuff that I don't think we consider to be that big a deal. I mean, if you're, you know, growing a backyard full of marijuana, I don't think most people think that you should go to jail for 40 years for that. And, you know, the mandatory minimums just shoot up if you have a firearm on your property. I mean, some of them are just ridiculous. So I was happy to hear him say that. Maybe the only time in the whole debate that I actually agreed with him. But it is funny the way that views have shifted so far over the years. And I think one of the reasons is the crime bill passed. A lot of people got locked up. We saw the ramifications of all these new mandatory minimums. And now everybody gets the fact that that was a really bad bill that passed. And, you know, it's funny to hear Biden say, oh, you know, I've changed my views on a lot of things. But he never explicitly just trashes a crime bill as a whole. He talks around it a little bit. Today he did say something about some bill that they passed 100-0, probably the crack cocaine bill he was talking about, that, you know, now he regrets. But he never, ever, you never hear him say that crime bill as a whole was something he regrets.
And I just don't know what the hell happened to the Democratic Party. Does this impact anything, you think?
You know, I'm going to roll back on that fracking, the fracking, oil and gas, you know, the talk about climate change. That's speaking right to the Rust Belt. And Trump was doing that in the first debate. He mentioned fracking specifically. I think to the target audience, to the voters that matter, you know, it may matter. It may matter a lot. I mean, this election, I think even though the polls don't indicate it's going to be close, I think we all understand that Trump voters don't get picked up by a lot of pollsters. So we're all expecting a reasonably close election. And if people in the Rust Belt states who haven't voted yet start getting really antsy about the idea of, you know, Hillary Clinton with a suit on, Joe Biden, you know, Hillary Clinton was running around saying that she was going to shut down all the, you know, all the coal industry in these areas. You know, if you got that same party pushing the message, maybe there's still an element in the Rust Belt that just is switching from Democrat to Republican, and they're gonna vote for Republican. They're gonna vote for Donald Trump again. And so I think it may be very important in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Minnesota.
You think that this moves the needle that much? Or, I mean,
a little bit, and a little bit may be all that matters, you know? I was watching today when they were comparing the polls from all these other years and saying, oh, look what happened. Look at what happened. The movement that we had from the polls in the last debate to election day. Fact of the matter is a lot of those just showed that the polls are wrong. You know, it showed that not actual movement, but when people actually voted, it showed that the polls are wildly off. So I firmly believe that Trump voters don't get picked up. I mean, and another thing, you know, I people laugh at me when I say this sometimes, but Trump is similar to Obama in one sense. You know, Obama had this loyal following, and they, you know, in midterms, they wouldn't show up. They would not show up for midterm elections. But when he was on the ballot, they would show up and vote for him. Same with Trump. I mean, that's why I think people look at the 2018 congressional elections and see that Republicans took a bath, and they use that model a little bit, part of that model for this election. This election is nothing like the last midterms. This is one where Trump's on the ballot. I think he's going to do a lot better than people expect.
You know, one of the moments that the left is going to make a lot of stink out of is the child separation question. Oh my goodness, the children are separated. Oh, and now there are 545 children out there that you can't locate their parents. Now, you're a parent of three, I'm a parent of two. If I were going into a country and I were separated from my children and then we got released from whatever detention center it was, my first and only priority would be getting my children back. I would not go, well, I'm here. I might as well enjoy Disneyland or whatever. I'm not you call me maybe later at some point or whatever if you figure out you're going to let my kids go or anything. If I'm not with my kids, I'm calling the government going, where in the hell are my kids? They say the government can't find these parents. A little known fact, and it's known, but it's ignored by these people in the media, is that a lot of these kids and their parents, in quotes, aren't actually kids and their parents. They have rent a kid because you're treated differently and better if you come across the border, or you were if you came across the border with a kid as a family. Like, oh, no, we can't separate families. We can't detain families. Your kid was your get out of detention free card. They changed that policy because people were renting kids to sneak across the border. So I would say a good chunk of that 545 kids that are allegedly looking for their parents, can't find their parents, are because they're not their parents, or they're really, really bad parents. I'll just say it. They're shitty parents. If you come across the border and get separated from your kid and then you get released, but your kid is still detained somewhere, or you're separated, my first act would be, where's my kids? And I wouldn't stop until I found my kids. Now, knowing that there are these kids out there, if you're sitting on a couch, sitting your ass somewhere, and you go, oh yeah, you know what? We did have somebody else with us when we crossed the border. Our daughter. maybe we should call the government. That these people aren't says something about them, whether they were rent-a-kids or whether they're really bad parents who just don't care, but it says something about them. Is this gonna, because the left is gonna make a big stink out of this, does this get traction, you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's been hashed and rehashed. I mean, we all know the facts of it. It's been out there in the public domain. It's been debated. I don't know. I mean, it's obviously, you know, it's not a great situation. I think it's odd. The way you explained it very well. I don't understand why Trump keeps saying you guys built the cages. I don't think that's a great argument to come back with. I don't think that's a compelling argument. I think he's not making a policy argument. He's just kind of, you know, sniping at the other side. But I don't know. It's one of those issues. I really think that the bigger issues are the, you know, Hunter Biden issue. I mean, when you think about what was Trump trying to do tonight, what was his goal? We all know his goal. He was trying to drive up the negatives of Biden. That's what he walked in with. He said, I'm going to go in there. I'm going to blow that guy up. I'm going to say he sucks on, you know, fracking and energy policy, and his son's corrupt. His brothers are corrupt. He made money off China and Russia and all these projects. And I think he did a decent job of that. I think, you know, the policy discussions will probably move people a little bit. And there'll be a controversy, but everybody knows what Trump is, what he's been fighting for, what he's been working on. So I think that issue won't move that many votes.
It was, I thought it was a very well-run debate. I thought it was a good debate. I think Trump did himself a lot of good. We'll see. The spin will be tomorrow. The question really, it's weird that there's a debate where the big question almost doesn't have anything, the next day is almost doesn't have anything to do with the debate. And that is, will the laptop, the corruption allegations, will that get legs? And that's really it. You laugh, but that's the story. Because Joe Biden presented himself as though, you know, I checked my halo just off the stage before I came out here. But believe me, I've got one. I'm an honest public servant as the day is long. And that line of garbage, which is pathetic at this point, he could fess up, like, look, if my son did stuff that I don't know about, well, I'm gonna talk to him about it, but I had nothing to do with it. You can't, if there's this drip paper trail. That's why I think he's being so vague in his response, because the second he says I never did anything, then suddenly an email from him pops up, or signed documents or something like that pops up, saying everything we did was above board is different, you know, because then you can argue that whatever you're caught doing, no, that was above board. And technically what Hunter is accused of doing and what he seems to have done in cashing in on his dad's name and position is legal. That's the thing that, Brian, you've worked in Washington for a long time. I've worked in Washington a long time. You hear stories like this, and it's perfectly legal. It's just scummy as hell. The Clintons getting $20 million from the Clinton Global Initiative to buy mosquito nets for sub-Saharan Africa, getting $20 million from Saudi Arabia, is perfectly legal. Now, Saudi Arabia could buy $20 million worth of mosquito nets, no problem. They're right there. They're above the Sahara, but they're right there next to Africa. They could get them there pretty easily. Why that money had to be filtered through a New York charity is a mystery for the ages, except for you realize that they were buying future good graces from the future president of the United States, because the Clintons lived large off of that charity money. It's scummy as hell. It's crooked. It's shady, and it's legal. And what Hunter is accused of doing is shady as hell. It's corrupt, and it's legal, largely because, unless he laundered money or something like that, because these people that benefit from their family selling their positions or giving access or whatever little favors on insignificant things in the grand scheme of things, the United States, with 6 degrees of separation, it's because they write the rules. They're the ones who write. That's why Congress can use the information they get for insider trading purposes. But if you or I did it, we'd go to jail. That sort of thing. That's why rich Congress members can loan their campaigns, even in safe districts, can loan their campaigns hundreds of thousands of dollars at an interest rate well above the prime rate, make a profit off of their campaign paying them back at a rate. They're actually making a profit. They're in the interest. Or someone like Ilhan Omar can spend 2/3 of her campaign funds on her husband's consulting. She can't take that campaign, can't take that $2 million and put it in her pocket, but she can legally put it in her husband's pocket and he can put it in their joint bank account because these people make the rules.
Yeah, I mean, the rules actually were changed because members were raising money for campaigns and they were allowed to keep them. So I think it was the mid-80s, you had a bunch of members.
Right, I remember that. And a whole bunch of members retired because they were going to have to cough up the money. And this was when Democrats controlled the House. It was largely a Democrat problem. It was like the next election cycle starting on the first of the year or whatever. This was going to be the new law. And a bunch of members with, you know, $500,000 in campaign funds sitting there said, then I'll just retire. Because if you're going to make me have to spend this or give it to another campaign, to hell with that. I'll retire and pocket this money. And it was like, it was almost like it's just a day that ends in Y. This is what happens in Washington, that all of these people said, well, then screw it. I'm leaving so I can be rich off of my campaign money. It was, now they found ways, workarounds though. The Ilhan Omar workaround is rather brilliant. Oh, I'm going to hire my husband as a consultant and pay him an ungodly sum of money in a race where I'm going to get 70% of the vote, even if I drop dead today. And we'll call it campaign consulting. And you can report on it. Our constituents don't give a damn. The media doesn't give a damn. And it's perfectly legal.
Yep. No, it's the way it is. Washington, D.C. writes these crazy rules. You know, if you get a book deal, that doesn't count. That's why you see a lot of these, politicians living in million-dollar houses, because they figure out the workarounds and, you know, they do a book or something and they end up making a ton of money off it. And, you look at Joe Biden. I mean, he's in and out of government. He's got a lot of money now. You know, Obama's making a ton of money. These guys get out of government. And they just cash out and make a ton of money. And, you know, the system is broken, but what's the biggest problem? It's because there's so much money coming out of Washington, and that's the problem. Taxpayers are being built, and they're, you know, getting robbed, basically, and they're paying all this money out that actually the federal government doesn't even have. They have to borrow it, and that's why there's so much money to be made in Washington with all these contracts and things that other people have going on with the federal government. You know, that's why you have a Burisma. That's why you have these other situations where people want to get influence, they want to get into the United States, they want to buy influence, they end up doing it. And it's, you know, who do you got to go to? You need to go to a guy like Hunter Biden, who's, you know, willing and able, very happy to talk to you and sit down and take money from these sketchy governments to get some access and to get help them get what they need.
It really is shocking. I always say, if you want to get money out of politics, you got to get the politics out of money. If the government weren't allocating, you know, such a huge percentage of our GDP every year, of course you're going to attract a whole bunch of people who want a piece of that action. And you hear these ungodly contracts. They were paying him $50,000 a month, $100,000 a month. My God. And it's like, everybody thinks that's insane. But if you pay a lobbyist $100,000 a month for a year and you end up getting a $5 billion government contract, there isn't anybody listening to my voice right now that wouldn't find a way to borrow $1.2 million if you get a $5 billion return on that. Yeah, that's the problem with government, is that government allocates so much that it incentivizes all of this crap. And then when that much money's at play and it's, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars, and a $5 billion contract is nothing. it's literally nothing to the federal government, that you can get that contract and nobody notice. Nobody notice that you're not qualified for that contract. Nobody notice that nobody else bid for that contract, that strings were pulled or whatever. And that's the problem with government. It's so big that it's the world's biggest trough and everybody's a pig and they just saddle up to it and get their taste of it. And I don't see any way to pull that back. Except to listen to the adhere to the Constitution. While I got you here, Brian, as we wrap up, Amy Coney Barrett was approved out of the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday unanimously, 12-0, because Democrats refused to show up. Mitch McConnell, I believe, is taking the nomination to the floor of the Senate today, Friday, and they're expecting a vote Monday, maybe Tuesday. What can we expect between then and now? Or have Democrats at this point just kind of said, this is going to happen. We'll make the stink that we have to, I guess, but it's going to happen. We're going to spend more of our time focusing on winning the election rather than harping on this.
No, they'll do their failure theater. They'll do a big make-believe fight in the Senate floor. They have to actually look like they're fighting, even though they know they're going to lose. So we'll see a dramatic walkout of the Senate or, you know, something. They'll do something to draw attention to the fact that they're opposing the nomination. Maybe just either boycotting the vote, a walkout, you know, some sort of a delaying tactic that delays it for a couple hours. I mean, nothing they will do will stop the nomination, but they will do something just to kind of raise a profile and to make believe that they're actually fighting it.
If Democrats boycott the vote, can you pass a Supreme Court nominee by unanimous consent?
I wouldn't do that. I mean, you can have a recorded vote. All you need is the quorum, and a quorum is 51. So all you need is, you know, you get 53 Republicans. If every Democrat boycotts a vote, you still can force it through, just like they did with the committee. You know, basically the committee rules say you can't do what they did, but they were like, you know, nobody's here. How about 12-0? We're going to send it out of committee. And same with the Senate floor. Like, you can't, Democrats can't fight and say we don't have a quorum if none of them show up. So, you know, they could delay it a little bit, but ultimately, if they walk out and just boycott it, it's going to be 53-0. Well, not 53. You'll lose a Republican or two. So maybe 51-2.
Does, if it's a foregone conclusion, do you get a Joe Manchin? Do you get a Doug Jones fighting for his life down south? Do you think anybody does that? Because I don't know what the benefit to Doug Jones is voting against Coney Barrett at this point.
Yeah, Doug Jones should just be confident in the fact that he's going to enjoy being a senator until the end of the year, and he's a week and a half away from losing. Because I think he had to have known when he won that seat that he was renting the seat and he was in borrowed time. I mean, I think, you know, Cory Gardner's looking like he's in trouble, Martha McSally and Doug Jones. Those guys are all in kind of the same boat where they're looking at staring at a very bad election day. But if you're Joe Manchin, what do? Maybe you vote no enclosure and you show up and vote for the nominee on final passage just to kind of cover your behind because you're in a pretty Republican state. But, you know, maybe not. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he plays team ball because he sees the handwriting on the wall that, you know, he thinks that Biden's going to be president. So, you know, Manchin is he's calculating politically. So I'm sure that he's looking at the tea leaves and saying, what do I need to do politically to be in the best position to have the most power in the next Congress? You don't want to tick off your own party if your own party, you think your own party is going to storm to a big victory on election day.
Well, Chuck Schumer is going to, I think Chuck Schumer will sit there and take names. He's kind of a vindictive prick. So especially if that's what Democrats have to hedge their bets on this. It's a game of chess, and it's so bizarre to think of it in these terms, but there's literally no principle here. There's no principle at all in here. It's Democrats have to decide whether or not they want to help their reelection chances in the next cycle or the cycle after that in something that could be held against them. Or if they can more than make up for it by not alienating Democratic Party leadership and getting plum committee assignments. Because Chuck Schumer decides where they go, right? On committees. So if they want, if there's an important committee to a Joe Manchin and he goes against Chuck Schumer, maybe he puts him in exile for a while, puts him on a committee that it doesn't impact West Virginia. It just, there's a lot of vindictiveness that could be done. And there's intra-party politics more so than anything principled going on at this point. That is a freedom that comes along with the vote being a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, look what happened to Dianne Feinstein for the offense of actually being nice to the nominee and saying that Lindsey Graham ran a nice hearing. She got, they were ready to kick her out of the party.
Yeah, and Chuck Schumer had a long, serious talk with her. And that's all I'm going to say about it. Like, what is that long series? I find that hilarious from the people who say Donald Trump is tearing this nation apart. He's dividing us. And somebody's nice to a Republican and like, don't worry, we'll whip her backstage and she'll learn one way or another. She'll learn.
Yeah.
Brian, final thoughts on the debate.
Well, it's all over now. We're on to election day. Let's see what happens. I thought Trump did a good job. I mean, I thought he did a good job in the first debate, even though people kind of, downplayed his efforts because he interrupted so much. But I thought he did okay. And this one, I thought he did better. And I think that he did fine. I think he did a good job in the debate. I mean, I don't think it was a decisive beatdown or anything, but I think he did a pretty good job and did what he needed to do. He needed to force the media to talk about Hunter Biden, and he got that done.
We shall see. We'll find out today. By the way, if you're listening right now and it's before 6 p.m. or 9 p.m. Eastern time on Friday, I will be on Newsmax on Spicer & Company back defending my title in trivia. A title that I beat you once. Yeah, I didn't take it from you, but I've beaten you before in this trivia. I think I'm 5-2.
You did take it from me. I was winning at one point, and then I.
Well, you were winning the game, but that doesn't matter. That's like saying you won the Super Bowl at halftime. I've won multiple times. I'm a freaking genius. Anyway, thanks, Brian. You can email me, DerekAllenHunter@gmail.com. You got the Curse Show tomorrow. All that good stuff. Have a great weekend. I'll see you guys back here on Monday.